Welcome everyone to episode 412 of the NBA podcast. I'm Morten Jensen, and today we'll be previewing the 2021 NBA trade deadline. Before we get underway, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. We're on iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, and leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we're recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is my close pal and confidant and usual host, who is no longer hosting because he's having a kid and is forcing me into that role, Brian Zaporek. How are you?
I'm doing well, Moritz. It's nice to be on this side of the table for a change.
Oh, I'm glad you think so. This was very, very difficult for me, so thank you.
You're very welcome, and thank you for doing it. As you mentioned, I am, knock on wood, if everything goes well, I will be having my first child within the next week. So we are preparing for my temporary absence. You will be taking over hosting duties for the next few episodes, and we thankfully have a replacement co-host in the meantime while I'm gone, who
we
is
do.
Kind enough to join us today as well.
We absolutely do. From Real GM, from Yahoo and Spotrac, Keith Smith. How are you, man?
I'm good, man. I like the way you said Yahoo. That kind of got me fired up and excited. I like that.
Well, we're talking trades, so how can you not be fired up?
That's it.
Right? So let's begin with the big topic that's been dominating the NBA news, despite the fact that the player is vehemently average, LaMarcus Aldridge. $24 million expiring contract. He's going to be 36 later this year. He and the San Antonio Spurs have agreed that it is time to part ways. And Keith, I'm going to simply start off with you. Where do you think LaMarcus Aldridge could end up? Because I'm seeing some challenges if he goes to the Spurs and says, I want to go to a contender. Because it seems to me that most contenders already have their financials like locked up. There's a reason they're contenders. It's because they don't have a lot of bad money on their books. So is it be difficult for Aldridge to actually go to a contender? And if so, where do you see him going?
Yeah, that's kind of the key point there. If he wants to go to a contender, it's going to have to be via a buyout, because there's not a contender that can match that salary easily enough to bring him in. So that's the challenge. I don't see the Spurs being willing to take back bad money or anything like that. I don't think we're going to be in any kind of position to see them doing that kind of thing. So I think ultimately Aldridge's best hope may actually be a buyout, which isn't the worst thing in the world, because he's still going to get most of the money he's owed anyway, and then he gets to pick his spot where he wants to go versus the Spurs having to really find something for him. I think that's likely where this one is headed. As far as who, I think he can fit with a lot of teams. I think, he as a second unit big who can be an offensive hub for you, I think he's okay. I think you can get a lot of run out of him. But if you're counting on him to come in and be a key starter that's going to really lift you and change your ceiling, you're probably a little bit misplaced on that.
And Brian, so I can't stop but thinking about this, because just a couple years ago, we had this whole who's the best power forward in the game discussion. It was before Giannis really took off, and it was LaMarcus Aldridge, Kevin Love, and now I'm even blanking on the name, Blake Griffin. That was that trio of names that were brought up. Two of these guys now are basically projected to be off the bench guys. Does this mean that Kevin Love won?
I guess that's one way to look at it, in the sense that he still has more money coming to him later this, after this season, that isn't going to be a minimum deal. So financially he won. But it goes back to your whole theory about, the archetype of that type of power forward just not being a thing anymore. And it speaks to, we saw it with Blake Griffin, he took a minimum deal to sign with the Nets. I think Keith is totally right. It's going to be hard to find a place for LaMarcus Aldridge to make sense on that contract. But Keith, I do want to ask you, because I feel like every time we've discussed trades within the last month, we keep coming back to, it's really hard to find a contender that can match that salary. But Boston has this giant $28.5 million trade exception. I would assume they're aiming higher than LaMarcus Aldridge, right?
I would hope so. If not, it's, I've got a whole new set of questions to add to the bottom of the very lengthy list of questions about the Celtics that I already have going. Yeah, the challenge is Boston can only use about $20 million of that trade exception right now. It's a little bit less because they are hard-capped. So because of that, that means that they only have a certain amount that they can use. What ends up happening there is the Celtics would have to send some money out. Now they can get there. They could send a couple contracts to the Spurs, get to where they need to be to get in under. But I just don't think Aldridge changes enough for them up front. He'd have to be a five in their system. And I think they're just as content to split those minutes between Daniel Theis, Tristan Thompson, and Robert Williams as they would be to add Aldridge into that mix.
Yeah. That makes total sense. And again, it's the question of, what do you expect Aldridge, not even for Boston, just any contender, like how much do you expect him to contribute? And I think he's probably along the lines of what the Nets expect out of Blake Griffin, where it's, this guy is not the all-star version of himself. He's not going to play 30 minutes a night. We're going to play him 10 to 15 minutes a game off the bench. He could be our backup center. That's great. Are we willing to give up enough in terms of contract equity and then also picks, prospects, whatever, to bring him in? Probably not. So, Mort, to go back to your question of, you know, where does he fit best? And I agree with Keith. Like, if he does get bought out, I do think a lot of teams should have interest. The Lakers, the Heat in particular, stand out to me. Portland, I think, would just be fun for sentimental reasons. But also, you know, he could actually provide that nice lift, especially with Nurkic still out. So that's one. The Warriors could always use more bigs as well. So I think he will find the spot. Like, I don't think he's going to be washed out of the league entirely, but I would be very surprised if the Spurs can find a taker. But I mean, I think it was Tim Bontemps or Adrian Wojnarowski, one of the guys from ESPN, said the Spurs have been engaged with multiple teams. So it sounds like there is interest in him somehow.
Right. And I actually want to touch on that a little bit, because one of the things that I brought up on Twitter as well the other day was, theoretically, the Spurs could be taking on long-term money instead. You know, it's a pretty weak free agency class. We know that the Spurs aren't really a tanking organization. They want to stay competitive. And if you do take on long-term money, there is the upside that you can actually get, potentially at least, a better player back than what LaMarcus Aldridge is right now, even if that player is overpaid and maybe not worth his contract. I don't know necessarily if the Spurs are interested in doing that, but I think it's an interesting component to how they might be thinking, because they're just not, as I said, that kind of type of team that bottoms out. So, Keith, I know you've been a little bit on the whole, you know, the Spurs should go for John Collins in the offseason, but do you think that they would be open to taking on long-term money if it provides them with a higher level of player that comes back in a trade?
Yeah, I think they would be. I just don't think that's going to happen. I don't know who that guy would be, right? That becomes your challenge, unless Aldridge isn't going to want to go to Oklahoma City, so it's not like there's like a Horford trade that would really work there that helps the Spurs, but also gets Aldridge, you know, off the books. And they're going to do right by him, right? They're going to send him somewhere he either wants to be, or they'll just buy him out and let him go. So I think that's where the challenge comes in, is what are you getting back for him? And that's where I think right now the Spurs, as things stand, without taking on any kind of money in a trade for Aldridge or doing anything else, I project them to have a right around $50 million in cap space this offseason. That puts them in the mix to kind of be, you know, the primary player for whoever they want, because it's such a poor free agent class. But there are a handful of guys. You mentioned, I love the John Collins fit for them, and I would throw him a max offer sheet and then force the Hawks to match it if that's the direction they want to go, or something along those lines. I just don't know where the good enough player to lift them comes from that you're going to get, because I don't think anybody's going to give up that kind of value for Aldridge.
Well, see, Keith, I'm just a little bit confused here, because you are actually arguing that the San Antonio Spurs, of all teams, takes on a guy who is only 23 years old. Is that even legal?
Yeah, right? You know what's funny, though, is, like, if you look, they're starting to go in that direction, right?
They are.
Now, it's all their own draftees and guys they acquired very, you know, young points. But yeah, they really hit on something in the bubble more out of circumstance than anything else because they didn't have Aldridge. They didn't have their main kind of guys. They really found something when they, I call it the mid-major lineup because it's one big and a bunch of smalls. And they really make stuff happen. And I think they are really well positioned to do some good stuff with that set up with what they have because all their key guys other you know I know DeRozan has had a nice season for them but he's probably done there and then everybody else that's a key player for them is under contract and in young and they still have all that cap space so I do think this is a chance just like when they went and got Aldridge I think you know we have it's what every 5 years or so maybe 6-7 years maybe even a decade the Spurs get active in free agency and I think this is where we're coming around to now.
See, DeRozan is an interesting question as well. You just brought him up because he has been playing well. He's been playing really well. And I know there are rumors that persist that he may want out or, you know, that the money that he's looking for isn't really what the Spurs are looking for. But I kind of like that fit. Are we completely out, Keith, on a DeRozan return this summer?
I'm not. I think that there is a chance for that, especially considering what the market looks like. If there's teams that are really kind of looking at it and saying, all right, he's not the fit for where we are and where we're going as a franchise right now and what we can pay him, then, yeah, I think his best option may be to return to San Antonio because I don't know that the Knicks are going to go in on giving him a big contract. I don't think Dallas is really where he fits all that well. The Hornets, they kind of have their you know up and coming similarly sized guy with a you know similar ish kind of game in LaMelo Ball so you're and you already have Hayward you're not going to invest more money there so I think that's the that there is an opportunity there one thing that I kind of like is you know if they really wanted to make a move with the design on keeping him in playing a similar type of role I think DeMar DeRozan would fit really well with the Denver Nuggets now, and I think you could get him by moving a couple contracts that are not great and don't make a ton of sense for you. And maybe you pay, you know, kind of pay the Spurs to take on a Gary Harris or something like that. And I think DeRozan, with his passing ability and his cutting ability, he would fit great in that Denver system because they've got enough shooting to offset the fact that he's not a shooter there and that. But you would only do that if you're really thinking, all right, he either lifts us to title contention this year or we're going to keep him beyond this season. But that's a fit if they were ever going to trade him. That I think makes some sense.
Brian, why didn't we never think of that?
I don't know. I mean, well, because the rumors about DeRozan's unhappiness, Jabari Young of CNBC was the one who just like kept pounding that drum before the bubble. But it seemed like, as Keith said, once they got to the bubble, shifted DeRozan to this like hybrid power forward role, he really seemed to find his groove and it just carried right over to this season. So I do wonder if that sentiment that was there, you know, pretty much all of last season still applies, especially given the market forces that Keith referenced as well, because it just, you know, there aren't a ton of teams that need a DeMar DeRozan this summer that are willing to spend, you know, up to nine figures on a long-term deal to get him. So if I'm the Spurs, I mean, one, they just aren't the type of organization that tends to, you know, prioritize the long term over the short term with their roster building. So I think they're going to, you know, knowing that they are in playoff contention right now, I think if they were where the Rockets were and just in a total tailspin, yeah, they'd be looking to dump not only Aldridge, but probably DeRozan, Patty Mills, Rudy Gay, all of these guys. But, you know, the fact that they're in currently the seventh seed, I believe, I would be surprised if they're like in a huge rush to move DeRozan. But yeah, I love the Denver fit. Keith, I'm going to just always bring up Boston with these talks, but you know, he fits into that trade exception too. Would Boston be interested in him?
Yeah, I think your challenge there comes in. It becomes about $8 million you have to send out to fit mm-hmm. him in, and that's where it gets a little sticky for the Celtics, because unless you're going to trade Tristan Thompson, which that comes with a set of, like, is that really a good look? Thompson prioritized Boston. He was just signed as a free agent. That's where it gets kind of hard, because now you're talking the Celtics have to send probably two or three guys San Antonio's way. Not a real issue for the Spurs. They can make that work. They've got an open roster spot. They'd open another one with DeRozan. They could waive, you know, an end a bench kind of guy, or work another trade or something like that. That's the tricky part. And I think Boston is trying to prioritize guys that they will either feel 100% we're going to re-sign them, or they have to be under contract for the next couple years, because this trade exception is their last chance for at least a few seasons to add a major piece, because they're going to be completely capped out. They're going to be over the tax starting next year when Tatum's extension stick kicks in. So that starts to become a little bit of the issue for the Celtics there.
But then let's get into the Celtics, but let's get into them through the perspective of the Sacramento Kings, because the Kings are reportedly going to be sellers at the trade deadline. It seems like they've come to their senses. They realize we're not going to have that big a chance of making the playoffs. The West is just too good for us to really compete. So they're considering selling off pieces. And according to Brian Scalabrine, at the least, I don't know how much stock we should put into that, the Celtics are all in on Harrison Barnes. Keith, is that realistic? Is that a scenario that could actually end up happening? Would he fit the Celtics? You watch more Celtics than both Brian and I do, I imagine. So, like, give us the inside scoop here on Harrison Barnes.
Yeah, realistic, absolutely. I think he makes $22 million, so Boston only needs to send about $3 million or so out. It's even a little bit less than that. So that makes it very easy to construct that kind of trade and stay under the hard cap. It does make them a tax team. There's been some speculation they'd rather not pay the tax, but my general answer to that is, yeah, everybody would rather not pay the tax. But if you want to play with the big boys, right, you have to at some point. That's just the way it works in the league. So I think as we kind of look at that is one of those things where I think what we really feel getting into that is, how do we, you know, is that the direction the Kings want to go? Or the Kings looking at it as, hey, we do have issues here, but Barnes isn't one of them. He's played quite well for them. You know, is the return going to be enough? Are other teams going to beat what Boston is willing to give up? Because the reality is, Boston's younger players, they haven't panned out and shown quite that level of ability. Or will the Celtics supplement and say, hey, we'll throw in a couple extra picks? If I was the Kings, I'd want those extra picks a little further down the line. I'd want them, you know, 2025, 2027, in that range, because I don't want them in the next couple of years, because those are probably picks 20 and later. So I would rather have them later, when who really knows what this team is going to become. So I think that's something you got to factor in. But when you really start looking at it, this one screams to me, it almost makes too much sense that's probably why it won't happen.
There. So are you're saying it's going to be a close call with the Celtics?
Yeah, I know Brian wants me to say that desperately. They're going to be in the mix on them. They've been in the mix. Those teams have been kind of circling each other, which is why Scalabrine reported it with the confidence he did. They've been kind of going back and forth for, you know, months, looking at this as, you know, kind of Boston and several other teams waited for Sacramento to fall out of it, which they have now done. But the challenge becomes, you know, is there going to be something that gets done there? I just don't know, because it's not a – this is not a case of being unwilling to make a move if you're the Celtics. I think it's more a case of, can they actually meet what the Kings' asking price is without getting crazy and without other teams beating that too easily? Mm.
On the court, I think there's something interesting as well, because when I see Boston fans or even just NBA fans in general talk about Barnes, you know, presumably to the Celtics, they always seem to slot him in as the Gordon Hayward replacement. I think I even said that at one point as well. But ultimately, I've kind of realized he's very different. Like, he's bigger, he's stronger, he's more physical. He's less of a finesse player than Gordon Hayward is and was for the Celtics. So I have to wonder, like, just moving forward, would that change the roles of both, you know, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum? Because I know that Brad really likes his non-positions to stick, that everyone is just a basketball player. But Barnes, to me, just because of the physicality, seems to me that he would almost have to guard, you know, some of the opposing bigs as opposed to maybe Brown or Tatum. Is that off?
No, you're spot on with that. What he becomes is he and the combination of Brown and Tatum's improved playmaking and ball handling, that becomes the Hayward replacement. They replace what Hayward was giving them offensively as a ball mover. They've gotten enough better at that can be there. Smart can do some of that as well. And then Barnes really slots in as kind of more of a 3-4 type player, much yeah. like Tatum is now. But that allows you to stay, you know, very flexible. You can really switch everything with Tatum, Brown, Barnes, and then Smart when he's in the game, even if Tice is in there alongside yeah. those guys, because he can hold his own. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that's the direction you're kind of looking at. There is those guys are all going to kind of get together, and then they can start to do different things. It's just the question I would have is, can you get away with Barnes playing super small ball five for some minutes against certain teams? And I think there are a handful of teams, especially in the Eastern Conference, where you could get away with that. And I think that's what makes it even kind of more interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look, at today's league, when you're 6'8 and, you know, 230, you're almost going to receive center minutes regardless of who you are. That's just how the league is right now. So that would be super interesting. I would love to see that lineup. And I think it's a really good point about the Smart, Brown, Tatum, Barnes, Tice lineup, and just in terms of switching, because Tice, as we know, is actually just, you know, 6'8, 6'9 himself, mm-hmm. but he's pretty nimble. We obviously know what Marcus Smart can do defensively. Like, that would be, I would argue, one of the most versatile defensive lineups you could find in the entire league.
Yeah, you're not going to have a whole lot of rim protection out of that. Tice can do some of that, but more as a help kind of guy than a traditional, you know, anchor back there. But that's what you're kind of looking for at that point. And that's what I think you're looking at is it never really came together when they went to – it was called the best five lineup for the Celtics when it was Smart, Tatum, Brown, Hayward, and Walker together, because they were just a little too small against almost everybody in that group. But if you could, when you really need stops at the end of games, you almost kind of go offense defense with probably Walker, and as weird as it sounds, you probably do it with Walker and Tice. Yeah. You know, and I know that sounds a little weird because you're going with the big and the small, but that's probably how you play it down the stretch. And I think that, you know, makes them, you know, a lot more versatile, interesting of a team. And then you have in the factor too, Barnes is under contract for a couple more years at what should be pretty reasonable numbers, $20.3 million, $18.4 million after this season. Those are good numbers for what he brings you. The other thing I also like is you should not have any issue with Harrison Barnes feeling at all kind of out of sorts in the way we kind of learned Gordon Hayward came to feel on this team as being the fourth or fifth guy, because that's what he was for a whole early part of his career. He was, you know, in that role, and I think he knows how to play that. And by all accounts, everybody in the league loves Harrison Barnes. He's just a good guy. People really like him. So that when you factor in all those things, again, it makes just so much sense. It almost becomes one of those things like, why has this not happened already? And to me, when it makes that much sense and it hasn't happened already, there's got to be something missing. And my guess is it's Boston's compensation back to the Kings just isn't good enough.
Mm. And just to close this off, this is something Brian and I have talked about repeatedly, and I think this is as good a chance as any while having you on. Can we please close the book on the possibility of Boston using the TPE for Jeremy Grant? It's just not realistic.
Yeah, it's not. I don't know what they would have to trade to make that happen, but it would have to be every pick that they have plus, you know, four or five of their younger guys. I mean, at this point, I wouldn't be shocked if the Pistons even said, no, we want Brown in a trade like that. Because let's just go through, right? Jeremy Grant wanted the bigger role, so he certainly doesn't want to come to Boston and be the fourth guy behind Tatum, Brown, and Walker. He could have just stayed in Denver. He was offered the same money from the Nuggets as he got from the Pistons, and he wanted to play for a black general manager and a black head coach. And I think people who just kind of blow by that, that's very disrespectful to me of yep. what he prioritized as important to him in this offseason. And it's, you know, And I think that's, you know, admirable that that's the direction he wanted to go. And then he also talked about how he wanted to make a difference in the Detroit community and make a difference, you know, in a underprivileged area and help them as they kind of come up and grow. He wanted to be a big part of that. I think you factor all those things in, the Pistons would have to be, you know, insanely blown away with an offer that's never going to come their way. That's why it's just not a realistic thing. Yeah, in a year or two, if things don't improve there, sure, absolutely. By then, you know, that's probably more on the table. But right now, not going to happen.
Yeah. See, we can finally close that book, Brian.
Well, yeah, James Edwards of The Athletic, who I believe he was the one who first had that story about, you know, why Grant chose Detroit. So first shout out to him for getting that because it was a really good story. But he's also, you know, Shams had the piece that came out recently that mentioned like Boston is interested in Jeremy Grant, which sparked this whole speculation. And then James Edwards had the piece that's like, that's great, but Detroit isn't trading him. Yep. So I think that's where that is. But Keith, I do have a question about, you know, the Barnes Boston rumors. I guess two questions. One, just in your conversations with people around the league, how do the rest of the league value some of Boston's young guys in terms like Langford and Nesmith in particular?
Yeah, they're still a real mystery box, those two, because Nesmith hasn't played enough. He was very behind the eight ball to start this year. A lot of people have forgotten with him. He was injured at the end of last season, in his college season, and he didn't get even the prep time, this weird kind of transition for an NBA rookie. He didn't even get a lot of that. So he came in behind. He hasn't been able to really catch up. He's shown flashes. And then Langford has been nothing but hurt for the better part of his first 2 years. He's finally cleared to return from wrist surgery. Now he's in the health and safety protocols. So he's going to be out for at least, you know, another, you know, probably couple of days at a minimum. So I think what you're looking at there is those two very much people around the league are looking at them and saying, all right, you know, they're interesting, you know, as a kind of toss in a deal. Sure, well, why not? You know, but they're not anybody who's going to headline anything for you and get you anything great. Probably the young player that's even semi-tradable on the roster is Robert Williams. He has a lot of fans around the league just because of his kind of overall skill set, his athleticism. But, you know, that's one of those ones where it's still, he's, you know, at times the third big in Boston, at times he's the backup. You know, where is he at? And then after that, it's guys like Grant Williams. He projects to be, you know, a solid role player eventually. And then Peyton Pritchard, you know, again, still a little bit of a mystery box and unknown as a rookie. Right now, looks like he'll be at a very least a high-end backup point guard. But again, none of those players are getting you anything. Like, you could see it with Tatum and Brown back in the day, right, when it was very people were kind of hammering on, you know, all right, hey, can we do, you know, something there to go get Kawhi or something like that? You could see that. Well, why they had that kind of level of potential upside. None of the rest of the young guys on Boston have that level of tradability or trade value right now.
Yeah. So then, I mean, I don't know if you've heard like what Sacramento wants for Harrison Barnes, but it just, if you were Danny Ainge, how much would you offer for him?
Yeah, I'd give up Langford or Nesmith, let them pick whichever one they want. If they want Grant Williams too, yeah, why not? You know, if that's the direction the Kings wanted to go. I don't think they're going to want Tristan Thompson. Celtics aren't going to trade Daniel Tice. That's just, you know, patching one hole while creating another there. So I don't think you're going to really see anything like that. So I think what you're then really start to become it looking like is, you know, what are you supplementing with in terms of draft picks? And if I was the Kings, I would ask at least initially, like today, the conversation would be, I want one of those young guys, you know, whichever one they prefer, and I want two first-round picks and see where it goes. And if Ainge box, then you hold out and see if you can get that from somebody else. And if somebody else won't give it to you, you circle back around and say, all right, you know, maybe we can do one first-round pick or something like that when it gets to the deadline. But there hits a point for the Kings, too, where it's not like this guy is bad and you got to move him. It's not like he's, you know, pulling an Oladipo and, you know, turning down extensions and making it clear he doesn't want to be there. You know, so this is, you know, situation where, yeah, if I'm the Kings, I play it out the rest of the year, then if the right offer doesn't come along before I take less than what I value him at.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm wondering. You know, I've kind of been going back to this point since the summer, and with like how much the Pelicans got for Drew Holiday. Not that Drew Holiday is not a better player than Harrison Barnes, he is, but just the price for a lot of these guys has gone so far through the roof that I think all of these other GMs are going to be pointing to, well, like, okay, James Harden got 8 picks plus good players, you know. Anthony Davis got 3 good players plus 3 picks plus a pick swap or something like that. Yep. So, like, the Kings have every right to ask for multiple firsts plus one of these young guys who, you know, as you said, is in a more of a mystery box than a known quantity. So I think what you are saying is spot on, and I would agree that, you know, Boston probably hasn't gotten there yet, or otherwise this deal would be done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, if we were even as recently as 2 years ago saying 2 first-round picks for Harrison Barnes, we'd be like, that's insane. You know, there's no way. But that's just, you're right, that's what the market has become now. It has become, you know, teams have been so willing to throw in all these picks and pick swaps and all this other stuff that's just the world we're living in now. And that's going to be something that I think reasonably the Kings should be asking for. And then if they don't get it, hang on to them into the summer and see what materializes then.
Wait, yeah, so you're definitely telling me that the Houston Rockets could not get Zach LaVine for Victor Oladipo in a single first-round pick?
Yeah. No comment on that one.
Oh, Chicago media. I will always love you. Brian, Marvin Bagley. We spoke about him on an earlier podcast. We actually sent him to Denver, much to the dismay of Nuggets fans, apparently. But he's supposedly available, and teams are already concerned about his salary, and he's on a rookie deal. Does that bode well for his future?
I mean, did being drafted by Sacramento bode well for his future? That was the first misstep, right?
Yeah, I would argue so. But also, and just to include this in your answer, does he also fit what we've been talking about in regards to like the power forward position?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question with him moving forward, is kind of where is he most useful? And, you know, can he be a small ball center? I don't necessarily know that that's his position long term. But, you know, until he starts shooting at a higher volume from three and becomes more consistent, he also can't be one of these new age power forwards. So how best do you use him? Can he be a starter on a, not even a championship contender, but just like a playoff team? I think that question 3 years into his career, unfortunately, is still very much unanswered. And as you said, Mort, this is from, I believe it was Sam Amick of The Athletic, who mentioned that, you know, the Kings are at least willing to take offers on Bagley because he's being paid almost $9 million this year. It's $11.3 next year. And this summer, he becomes eligible for an extension. So it's decision time for them. Like, if they don't think Marvin Bagley is a long-term fit with this core, they've got to figure out something. And, you know, maybe the fact that he's had such a somewhat disappointing start to his career will limit the type of offers he gets in restricted free agency. So maybe they're comfortable. Like, I don't think it is an Atlanta John Collins situation where Atlanta has to assume John Collins is getting a max or near max this summer. I cannot imagine Marvin Bagley at this point in his career, you know, when 2022 free agency comes up, I highly doubt he gets a max offer sheet unless he takes just a meteoric leap forward next year. But yeah, I mean, does a team want to, you know, A, shell out enough salary to get his $11.3 million cap hit on the books next year, and then also worry about, okay, we just acquired him, we have, you know, 2 months or so with him unless we go on a playoff run, and then we've got to decide whether to give him an extension. You know, it is a tricky spot for both the Kings and whoever else would be sniffing around. If, you know, I think, I don't think any contender would want to bring him on because I just don't think they know what they're getting out of him. I think it's probably teams in the more rebuilding mode. Like if OKC wants to take a flyer on Marvin Bagley, that's, you know, that's more of Houston Rockets as well. Like those are the types of teams that should be sniffing around.
So what is his value in your opinion right now? Just what can you get for him if you're the Kings?
I mean,
oh yeah. See, you're on the other side of this. I'm playing the host now, so I don't have to answer all those questions. How does it feel, man?
Like, I have no inside knowledge here, but I would be. I think if they could get a late first for him at this point, they should probably take it, right?
I would agree personally, Keith. Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, if you can get a first for him, absolutely. Yeah, I would want, you know, a first and maybe a guy who, you know, could pop, you know. And I think, Brian, you made a great point. The teams that make sense for a guy like Bagley right now are teams like OKC, Detroit would make sense for him. Any team that's kind of in that rebuilding phase where you could bring him in and, you know, if he pops for you. But then I have to look at it and say, well, aren't the Kings kind of in that position? So why not just keep him and let him pop there if he's going to pop? But yeah, if you could get a first for him, yeah, I think, you know, sadly enough, it's, you know, I just wonder if this is one of those ones where it's just never going to happen for him in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. You know, we see that across the league. It happens to all sorts of guys. I mean, where I live here in Orlando, we're in year, you know, 7 of wondering if it's going to ever happen for Aaron Gordon, right? So, you know, and then, you know, are you going to extend into a second contract with Bagley and all that stuff? The good news is, if it was still the old front office, I think they still have the specter of, hey, we passed on Luka for this guy hanging over them, so we can't give up on him now. But I think with the new front office, I think you're in a position where they didn't make that move. They don't have this attachment to them. It's not the stigma on them. It'll hit the franchise some. But if they feel like the best thing to move on is move on, they can do that a little bit more freer than the old front office could.
Yeah, and we saw that with Philly, too, with Fultz, where it was like, if Colangelo was still there, they weren't going to give up Fultz because this is the guy that they traded up for, passed up Tatum for.
Yep.
Then he leaves, and they took, you know, a top 20 protected first that ultimately did convey, which was a pleasant surprise. But, I mean, I think that's probably the type of return you're looking for Bagley as well. So, you know, I take it back. I guess there are a couple of playoff teams, like the Spurs we brought up earlier. That could be an interesting landing spot just given their track record of player development and, you know, considering they're currently in the playoff mix. Like, if they're willing to give up, I don't even know if I do a lottery protected first, but if they, you know, if you point to the Fultz return and say a top 20 protected first and, you know, I guess LaMarcus Aldridge, if you want to, like, maybe there's some bigger deal there. Like a Corey Joseph and Marvin Bagley for LaMarcus Aldridge, something like that, plus a top 20 first, sure. But otherwise, you know, the Knicks, maybe if they're also still in the mood to take flyers, but I don't think they should necessarily because they have Mitchell Robinson, they have Toppin as well. Don't crowd out Toppin after mm-hmm. you just spent the number 8 pick on him. The Hornets, maybe, just because, you know, that the front court is the area of need for them as well. But, yeah, I can't imagine a team like, you know, either of the LA teams, the Jazz, the Suns, the Sixers, the Nets, the Bucks. Why? Like, what salary are you trading in the first place? I guess the Nets could trade Dinwiddie, but does Marvin Bagley really solve any of their issues? And no.
Yeah, no, he doesn't. If you look at another rebuilding team where I think he could actually make sense and be kind of interesting to see him develop is with Cleveland. If Cleveland mm-hmm. could get him, put him with the two young guards, with Okoro, with Jared Allen, now all of a sudden you got a group of 5 young guys that could really become something. And if Bagley doesn't pop, well, you've got the other 4 guys that you're feeling pretty good about. But the challenge there becomes, you know, what do you say? Are you sending Jetty Osman back? Do the Kings even want him? You know, you're probably not committing a pick. Cleveland does have an extra pick coming their way, if I remember correctly. Let me look that up. So if they maybe they don't. Oh no, they moved it in the trade for Jared Allen. So yeah, so that starts to become really kind of hard to find a real good match there for them. I think this is one where if you're the Kings, you ride it out at least into the summertime and then see, you know, how things come together at that point.
I have to ask just because I'm trying to stay optimistic here. Bagley is only 21. Granted, 2 days from now, he'll turn 22, but that's still super young. What do we put more stock into? His age or lack of the same, or the fact that he's played almost 3,000 career minutes? What do we look at as an indicator of there's still time, or from the other spectrum, he doesn't maybe not have the same ceiling as we thought. Where are we on his future progressions, considering age, considering situation? Is there a chance that he could turn into something much more than he is currently? That's for both of you.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me, what becomes worrisome is the amount of time he's missed with injuries. Mm. That he's missed. I mean, he missed basically all of last season. He was hurt pretty early on, and then never really kind of came back from that. He missed some time his rookie year as well, and then this year he has been available, and he's played, I think, in most, if not all, of the Kings games. But that's what concerns me more. And then I always get nervous when it's foot and leg issues. Well, with a big man, that always makes me worried. You know, I probably need to get over that because Brook Lopez had that early on. He went on to have a good long career. I mean, clearly Joel Embiid has overcome, you know, that issue. But yeah, it becomes, you know, kind of an interesting question. I would probably lean more towards he's still young and it could still pop, because I think when you also factor in he's young and he's been in a really messy situation in Sacramento, you know, maybe that's also held him back some too.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree, Keith. I think age is, you know, as you said, the fact he missed most of last season, you know, 2,800 minutes through 2.5 seasons is not a ton of playing time. Like, it's unfortunate that you have to make the contractual decision on him either this summer or next summer. So I think that's kind of leading this feeling of, okay, what is this guy? We need to figure this out sooner than later. But there's still a good player in here. It's just he might not be, you know, he's always going to have the Luka stigma over him. And he's not going to be a guy who you can just plug and play anywhere. Like, he mm-hmm. might be a guy who, if you have the right types of players around him, then he fits well and he can maximize his role. But until he expands his game, you can't just drop him into any system and say, okay, this guy's going to be a productive player playing 30 plus minutes a game. I just don't think that's the case. But I'm not out on Marvin Bagley by any means. I mean, right. We've seen, you know, how many guys who have gotten off to slow starts in suboptimal situations. I feel like Victor Oladipo is honestly one of the best mm-hmm. cases for this in recent years, where he was on that Orlando team for, you know, first 4 years, I believe, of his career. And then OKC, he went and started to show a little bit more. And then he goes to Indiana and just totally explodes. And you're like, oh, this is what he looks like with good teammates around him and in a higher usage role. Okay, cool. And, you know, some guys, it just takes longer to figure it out, too, for whatever reason. It's, you know, they, especially for someone like Bagley, who's missed a ton of time, like, just having a normal season, whether it's because of injuries or COVID, like, maybe next year he comes back and is just a totally different player. So, yeah, I'm not out on him yet. I just don't think, like, is he ever going to live up to Luka? Is he ever going to live down? I was drafted over Luka. Absolutely not. That ship has totally sailed. But, mm-hmm. you know, is he going to be out of the league in 2 years? No.
Yeah, and I think bigs, too, there's always the fact that bigs take a little while to develop. And Bagley's been in this weird big man position where it's been, you know, all right, we want you to play the four and play mostly on perimeter. No, now we want you to be a five and play inside. He's never really had that kind of even consistent role. Like, I look at DeAndre Ayton. I think what DeAndre Ayton benefited from and why he's taken the leap he did is he's been in a consistent role. We want you to do this. Just do this. Where Bagley, it's where we're going to shuttle you back and forth between these things, and he's never really gotten overly comfortable, I think, being, you know, what he, you know, ultimately may be, which I think what he is more of a stretch five type, you know, more in the kind of Miles Turner-ish, you know, kind of vein, who can, you know, bounce around, block some shots, do a little bit of rebounding. He's a better rebounder than Turner, his worst shot blocker, but, you know, the guy who play, you know, little outside, maybe finish ultimately better as a role man than Turner does. I think that's where, you know, you could eventually get him to, but you got to put him in that role, let him stay in that role versus shuttling him back and forth from, hey, be our center, not actually be our four. You know, play outside, play inside, you know, play as the role man, play as pick and pop. Like, it just gets very messy. And I think that that combined with the lack of playing time and injuries has made it very hard for him to define what he could be. And I think that's where his development has stagnated.
Yeah. Didn't they want to play him at the three occasionally as well? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, so. that was one of those, I think, crazy Vlade Vivek. You know,
he can be
the three and the four when we play four on five. And
And I mean, also, it's worth noting, he's, you know, his head coach is Luke Walton, who, if he is not the worst head coach in the league, he's certainly in the bottom tier. So that is also a factor contributing to, I don't know what his ultimate ceiling is, because he might be hampered by the coaching situation in Sacramento, which by all accounts, it just sounds like they're keeping him because they don't want to pay for two coaches. It's not, they think he's a good coach.
Yeah, and they're not the only ones. There's a couple teams in that boat.
I think ultimately, at least from my perspective, with just to tie up Bagley, it's also the lack of playmaking, right? I mean, it seems like he's always being used as the guy being set up. He's not being asked to set up anyone else, which, okay, that could be fine if that's just the role that you have. But then in that case, I would want more. I would want more offensive production. I would want more offensive versatility. But I also get being shuffled back and forth through positions. That's just not going to help you. But I'm just getting that same vibe. And Keith, just to clue you in, Brian and I, we've had this conversation for, I think, about half a year or something, where we've basically looked at a lot of the league's power force, like, you know, somewhat natural power force, like John Collins, Lauri Markkanen, Marvin Bagley, like players who aren't inclined to play a lot of center, and players who aren't really playmakers, and guys who aren't really that good at dribbling the basketball and putting the ball on the floor, generally speaking, like guys who are somewhat forced to be set up and having be relied upon by others to be productive. I think ultimately we're seeing an NBA where teams are shying more away from guys who have to be so reliant upon others. It certainly feels that way. It certainly feels like nowadays you're preferring like someone like Harrison Barnes, coincidentally, who's now averaging 3.5 assists, for example, that you can put guys at certain positions and they can play make either for themselves or for others. So you're just not reliant on having one guy who's moving around looking for a shot and cannot create anything off of his own merit. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. I think if you're a dependent player, you either need to be offensively an ace shooter, who's, you know, just you run sets and get things set up to for them to shoot, a Davis Bertans type, or you need to be a top end defender, and that usually becomes a big man. Everybody else, if you can't do anything off the dribble at all, you're gonna find it hard to be in the league. It's just where the league is now. You need to be able to attack. Defenses have gotten so good in the NBA. I know that sounds weird in this season where everybody's scoring, you know, 115 points a night, it feels like. But that's because teams play a little faster now than they used to. But I think what becomes really interesting in the league now is if you can't keep up and you can't create off the dribble at all, and you're not a good ball mover, or you're not somebody who at least, you know, we could throw it to you, you could take a couple dribbles and make a play, or we could throw it to you inside and you can make a move and finish, you're gonna find it really hard to stick unless you are an elite shooter, like I said, or you are a top tier defender like a Rudy Gobert type. And that's downgrading Gobert a little bit offensively because he's a little bit better than that, but he's still largely a dependent player. He's not setting himself up all that often. And then, you know, and that's a little harsh on Bertans, but that's mostly what he is now too. And that's okay. There's still a place for those guys, but you have to be elite at that other thing if you can't have a little bit more of a well-rounded game. Like a guy I think about all the time, he gets nobody excited and nobody gets fired up about him, But Kyle Anderson is in the NBA and has a starting role, or at the very least a high-end bench usage role, because he can do a lot of different things. He can move the ball, he can dribble, he can pass, he can shoot just enough. That's why guys like him stick around forever, because they can do those kind of things. That's more valuable than, you know, a guy like Bagley, who right now, well, what are you? You're big? Okay, but like, that's all, literally all you really show me right now is you're tall and you can kind of, you know, shoot a little bit if you're set up in the right way.
Yeah. Yeah. Versatility really seems to be the key. It really does. I do take offense with you saying that Rudy Gobert is reliant, because he's one of the elite playmakers in the league, right? Screen assists?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Tony Bradley's coming for his crown.
Oh, God.
That's what we really need to get into. Embiid's on the market now, right after Bradley's performance last night. Yeah, you'd sell high on Embiid. And
he does he fit the Boston CPE? I don't think so. Right?
Does he? Let me look and see. Those two teams have got together on a trade before.
He's a little too expensive, unfortunately.
Oh, man. I was just about to fire off a couple thousand words on how you make that happen.
Oh, I'm sure that your contributors over at Celtics Blog will definitely pick that up.
Yeah, absolutely.
You get like a million reads on that, even though it wouldn't be cap legal.
No doubt.
It's called the ESPN model, and it's great. So, Brian, we've covered Marvin Bagley extensively now. Which other candidates on the Kings could find new homes? You actually brought someone up earlier in a fake trade scenario, and that was Corey Joseph. Never really quite lived up to his contract. Do you think there's any takers for him, and who else do you see out there on the Kings that could be candidates to be moved?
Yeah, I'm writing a big trade deadline preview for the Sixers for Forbes before I go on temporary leave, and yeah, I'm breaking it down by archetype of player, and I got to the playmakers, and I was like, you know, D'Lon Wright, George Hill, Lonzo Ball, and I got to Corey Joseph, and I'm like, should I include him? I guess so, but I don't know if there's going to be a huge market for Corey Joseph. He's got 12.6 this year. I believe 2.4 of his 12.6 next year is guaranteed as well. So I just don't think teams are going to really want to pay Corey Joseph that much money next year, especially if there's a George Hill on the market who has a smaller contract and a smaller guarantee next year. I feel like he is a much more desirable target in that mix. You know, we've heard Nemanja Bjelica mentioned repeatedly. The Sixers have been tied to him multiple times, so I think he does move, and I think it would be very full circle for him to come to Philly after he originally came to terms with them in 2018 and then spurned them to sign with the Kings and then spent three years in purgatory. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's a guy, you know, $7.2 million this year. Any team that needs a stretch big, you know, he's not shooting especially well this year, but I believe he's like a 39% mm-hmm. career 3-point shooter.
Yeah, he's good.
Above 40% from the last 3 years from three. So I think he's probably the guy to keep an eye on, just, you know, smaller salary and fills that niche need off the bench.
And he can score off the dribble a little bit, too. I think people forget that. It's not like he's going to kill people, but I think people have this mindset of he's Ersan Ilyasova, who's a standstill shooter only. Bjelica can put the ball on the deck a little bit. He's like caught in between Ilyasova and Bojan Bogdanović, kind of, in his game. He's not as good off the bounce as Bogdanović, but he's better off the bounce than a guy like Ilyasova, and that's where, you know, he comes in as a valuable guy. I'm with you. I think he's the most likely player to move. You hit the nail on the head. If you can go get George Hill, you get George Hill. Joseph's best hope of being a trade piece, and I guess the Kings' best hope, is there's like a rash of point guard injuries on contenders, and somebody just needs anyone who can play 10 to 15 minutes a night there. The guy who interests me a little bit, and I haven't gotten a great feel for what their long-term outlook is Rashawn Holmes. because he's going to be an unrestricted free agent. The Kings are going to have to pay him. Again, all these teams with cap space, somebody's going to throw him probably, you know, $10 to $12 million a year would be my guess to come in and play for them as a starting five. And if the Kings want to keep him, they'll have the leg up to re-sign him and keep him. But I do wonder if they don't see him as that kind of player, or if they see it as we got to play Bagley at the five moving forward or something like that, then, you know, I think Holmes, he only makes $5 million, but that's a guy who can get you probably get a first round pick back for him, and that's you know, not a bad investment considering what you paid him over the last couple of years.
Yeah. No, he's been, Brian and I have we've spoken about him a lot on this podcast. He's one of our favorites. He's just been superbly efficient, understands role. I did a Twitter thread on him I think a month or so ago, all Biden Danish. But it's like he's so smart. The way that he cuts and times his cuts and understands, you know, where he is on the floor at all times, I think a lot of contenders could look at him also because of his salary. Like, he doesn't take up a whole lot and go, we could use him as a third big immediately, and he would get locked in for 24 or 25 minutes per game easy. I would be almost shocked if the Kings did not get a good offer on him.
I'll tell you what, too. I think he is another year or two away from starting to take a handful of three-pointers per game and knock him down at a relatively decent clip. He hasn't done that yet, but he's an excellent free throw shooter for a guy his size. He's, you know, consistently now, you know, in around, you know, 75% to 80% over the last few seasons. So I think there's a potential there that he could really start you know, extending that range a little. He did that, I want to say it was one of his years with Philly, and, you know, they had him shooting jump shots, but you know, but that was more, you know, that was the time when everybody was doing whatever they wanted with Philly, but that was okay, right? I mean, that was the goal there. And he actually shot him at a decent clip. So I think there's a chance, you know, as he ages, he'll add that shot, which will kind of round his game out a little bit more.
Yeah. I'm really glad they sold him for $1 million in cash. That was a great, really great trade.
Jeremy Grant, too.
I know. Yeah. But no, I'm right with you on Holmes. I mean, I think as good as Christian Wood's contract looked for Houston last year, it's going to look even better this year when we see what Rashawn Holmes gets, because I think he'll probably get at least as much money or like right in that same range. And I'd probably rather have Christian Wood than Rashawn, with all due respect to Rashawn, who I also like. But yeah, it's a fair question from Sacramento's perspective of, are you willing to pay this guy? Do you believe in him as your long-term five? Maybe they just want to go back to Hassan Whiteside. They could build around him again. So
yeah,
they're just like, thank God they have Fox and Halliburton, because they are just a complete mess otherwise. And I mean, Buddy Hield, you know, it sounded like the real trade rumors were leading up to last year's trade deadline, because he got benched for Bogdan Bogdanovic early, and it was also a Luke Walton thing. It seems like that has cooled down somewhat, but then with the emergence of Halliburton, that raises the question, you know, should that be your backcourt of the future of Fox and Halliburton starting? Is Buddy Hield going to come off the bench again? Is he not going to take kindly to it? He's on that declining contract where it's 24.7 this year, and then it basically just drops $2 million a year for the next couple of years. So I don't know that they're going to find a taker for him, because hasn't been as consistent of a three-point shooter this year as he has been in years past. And it sounds like, I mean, based on rumors, I think leading up to after the, like, last fall, I want to say, coming into free agency last year, I thought there would be more interest in him than there was, just on the trade market. So I think the NBA at large may be lower on him than most of NBA Twitter, but a high volume shooter like that, a career 40.6% shooter, he's a guy that I would at least keep my eye on to see if anyone could make a big swing for.
Yeah, that's a good point. Sorry, Mark.
I was just going to ask if he's realistic for Philly at all.
I don't think so.
Right? Contractually, it's going to be difficult?
Yeah, like they would have to give up Danny Green, and I don't think they'd want to do that.
Yeah, I think you're solving the shooting hole there, and you're creating a big defensive target.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, based on the amalgamation of reports coming out of Philly, aside from the Kyle Lowry stuff, it really sounds like Morey is focused on, like, let's shore up that sixth, seventh spot mm-hmm. in the rotation. Like, we feel pretty good about our starting five as is.
Mm. Yep. And they should. I mean, realistically, right? They've been fine. They've got the balance that they want. I don't think you're in a spot there where you need to do anything on that side. Yeah, it's the bench, as it has been for the last couple of years, right? Is get a couple more guys off the bench, and you'll feel good. And I feel better about Morey doing that than I have anybody else, because that's been his MO with Houston, right? For years has been, all right, I'm going to tweak. And then, you know, here we are. So, yeah, I think from everything I'm getting from the Kings, Buddy Hield is fine there now. And I think they're realizing the way you win now in the league is multiple guys who can attack and shoot. So I think they're good to keep him, Fox, and Haliburton all together. And they'll let that sort itself out over the next couple of years. If Haliburton grows into a role where he has to start, then you can start to look at a Hield trade at that point. And I think right now, though, this is just, you know, let's continue to grow it around these three and go. They're I think seen kind of as Fox is your number one guy, Haliburton's two. And then I think it's pretty clearly now Buddy Hield is third on that list on that team.
Yeah. And I mean, they can play all three of those guys together. Like, yep. The lineups with those three are just flamethrowers. Mm-hmm. So, the good thing is that Haliburton's on that rookie deal. So it's not like you're paying your entire salary cap to the backcourt. Like, you're paying a ton for Fox and Hield, but, you know, if you mentally offset it as like, okay, we're paying 29 million for Haliburton and Hield combined, like, let's just pretend we're splitting it 14.5 each, then it becomes much more palatable. And with Hield's contract going down, I don't think they should be in a rush to move him.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you.
All right, guys, we have two teams left to talk about, the Orlando Magic and the Houston Rockets. Let's start with the Magic. They also could find themselves as sellers before the trade deadline. And Keith, I know that's something you've been touching on Twitter as well, that, you know, it's time now. Like, they've been given a lot of time. Like, the main core has been given a lot of time together. It hasn't really worked out in the way that, you know, they probably hoped. They made two trips to the playoffs, and that's about it. And that's since 2014, I want to say, when they got together. You know, what are we looking at here from Orlando? Is it just clean house in terms of Vooch and Gordon and Fournier? Although, granted, of course, Evan Fournier is a free agent after the season. But are we looking at a complete teardown, or are we looking at a retooling process where it's like maybe one or two pieces and that's about it?
It's going to be the latter, much to the dismay of myself and many, many, many Magic fans. They are not in that position, and they have some reason to be there. So let's start with Vooch, right? He's the best player on the team. He's a legitimate all-star. He's one of the better offensive centers in the game. There's no reason why, you know, every team in the league that doesn't already have somebody in place at that position shouldn't be trying to get him. For Orlando, you know, it's easy to look at it from the outside and say, well, you know, the Magic aren't going anywhere. It's time to trade this guy. But the reality is they have nothing behind him. Mo Bamba is not ready. He has not been that guy. He has not shown he is anywhere close to being that guy now in year number three. So if he was better, I think you would see a more likelihood that Vooch gets traded, because I think what then happens is you can move him and give Bamba the minutes in the starting spot and move on. But because he's not, they're going to hang on to Vooch, and they're going to continue to go. And what their hope is, we get Jonathan Isaac back next year. We get Markel Fultz back next year. We have better health out of Gordon, better health out of Terrence Ross. We'll kind of patch some of the other holes as best we can, and off we go. We're still feeling pretty good about what we have. Cole Anthony, Chuma Okeke have shown some promise. So, you know, we feel like we can get right back in being a playoff team again. So you're not going to see Vooch get moved unless it's an absolute, you know, one of these, you know, deals where it's like, holy cow, they got the Harden package for Vooch. Well, then, yeah, they'd do it, but they're not going to get that. Aaron Gordon, less likely. You're probably not going to see him get moved either, because they're still big believers in him. Terrence Ross, everybody wants wing shooting at the trade deadline. But again, I think they're looking at it as he's a guy who fits either off the bench, or we could start him next year if Evan Fournier goes. And I think Evan Fournier, Kem Birch, and then the perpetually tradable James Ennis at the deadline, those three I think are the most likely guys who move. Fournier's an expiring contract. There's a lot of questions of if he'll be back in Orlando or not. Birch is probably going to start to slide behind Bamba in the rotation the rest of the way this season as they turn more towards development for those younger pieces. So Birch is a guy who could help, a very cheap contract. And then Ennis is just, you know, I think his destiny is to be moved at least, you know, 7 trade deadlines in his career because, you know, again, everybody wants shooting. So, you know, and in theory, that's what James Ennis is. And then teams get him and then they're like, oh, yeah, he's not really that guy. You know, so, and that's, you know, happened now with multiple teams, including Philadelphia, as Brian knows. So, you know, that's where I just think, you know, that's where the Magic are at. You know, maybe a Fournier trade happens, but I don't think you're going to see much else.
But, I mean, so it's interesting to me that they are looking at this and going, we still have a chance here. We kind of like where we are. Now, I understand it. Logically, Jonathan Isaac is going to return and be a positive defensive asset. Markelle Fultz, we saw him play some of the best basketball of his career this year. So if you're banking on those to return at the level that they were before they went down, yeah, absolutely, they would be at a stable place. But at no point would I look at that roster and go, yeah, sure, it's stable, but it's not something that could go to the finals. It's not even close to that. Nope. So what is the next step here for the Magic? Like, what do they need to do to actually flip the script from being, I guess, satisfied with what they have and actually turn into a legitimate contender?
Yeah, there's where you hit the nail on the head. Satisfied with what you have. Unfortunately, not every team in the league is always trying to win the championship. And I'm not saying Orlando doesn't want to win an NBA title. They want to, but not every team is pushing for that. Teams like them, Charlotte, Atlanta, those teams are content right now. Just let's be playoff teams. If it all comes together right, we'll make a run. That's exactly what happened for Orlando twice in their history. Everything came together. They made a run and nearly, you know, won titles and then, you know, fell short. And then it's, you know, let's just be in the mix. The other thing that's important for them is they don't re-lose the market. They were starting to lose traction here in Central Florida a little bit, which was scary for them because they are the only Big Four sports team in town. But everything is secondary to college football here in the state of Florida. Doesn't matter. You know, and UCF is now beloved down here. So what happens is the Magic, nobody really cares until around Christmas in a normal year anyway. Then if the Magic aren't good, they're just kind of, all right, I'll go to a game here and there. And then the Orlando City soccer team became so huge here that people got so into that, that if the Magic weren't, there wasn't a reason to watch them in the springtime when the soccer season started. Everybody was out. They were like, whatever, I don't really care. So that's where they were, you know, they meant a lot to them to make these last couple runs to the playoffs and win a playoff game in each of those times because it got people re-energized. It got them excited. It got them fired up. I think what they see this year is it's now a step back. The wheels have come off. This season is lost. I think they're now 5 games behind the play-in tournament or something in that range. So I think what they're looking at is we can do a soft reset, get a pretty good draft pick. Maybe, as has happened multiple times in franchise history, we get some lottery luck and we can jump up and get one of these great players. And now all of a sudden we become a far more interesting team moving forward. And then in a year or so, we can then reevaluate. All right, is it now time to cash in on Vucevic, Ross, Gordon? Is that when the time comes to do that? It's just not right now for the Magic.
It seems like a very passive form of team building.
Yeah, I think so. It's certainly not tear it down to the studs and restart. The other thing is, I mean, they did that and it really went poorly. I mean, yeah. they were terrible for years. It didn't go good. I think there's some reluctance from not the front office per se in Jeff Weltman and John Hammond, but from their boss, Alex Martins, a little bit maybe from the DeVos family to say who owns the team to say, you know, I just don't know that we really want to go that direction again. And, you know, as we all know, if you don't have full buy-in from your ownership group, you cannot tear it completely down and start over. It never worked. works, because what happens is they get super impatient about a year or two in, and then they force you to start doing all sorts of stuff that kind of sidelines what you were trying to set up and build. So Orlando tried that. It didn't necessarily work out. Anybody who they did get in that process went on to blossom elsewhere, unfortunately, whether it be Oladipo or Tobias Harris, or, you know, we could play this game, which is not fun for Magic fans, for the next hour. But that's kind of, you know, where it's at with them. They're more content to, let's build with what we have. If circumstances cause us to fall, circumstances cause us to fall. I think you'll see a little bit of a stealth tanking the rest of the way. I think you might see Vooch get a night or two off here and there, because I think they realize they're kind of out of it this year, but I don't think they're going to do it by virtue of, you know, a big fire sale and start moving all sorts of pieces.
At least they can be satisfied to know that Mary Hosonia, who they drafted fifth, got a very warm reception when he landed in Greece.
Andy blocked LeBron's game winner one time.
For another team. Yeah. All right. So just to get this out of the way and to wrap up the Magic, what should they demand in return for Nikola Vucevic? Now, you said something interesting. They're not going to move him now unless it's like for a James Harden return. But then you said, like, they're going to buy their time a little bit. Eventually, maybe if they feel the market is right, they would pull the trigger. So what is, like, the right price here for Vooch and maybe even also Aaron Gordon? I'm not even going to include Evan Fournier, because I have to assume the return is going to be so small because he's a pending free agent. So for Vooch and Gordon specifically, and Keith, for the love of everything that is holy, try to get our guy Aaron Gordon to Denver, because Brian and I have talked about that for 4 years.
Yeah, all right, I'll start there with Gordon. Yeah, I think it's a good young player back, maybe one that fits a little better, balances the roster, because Gordon and Isaac still is a weird fit at the forward positions. You have this dream of them being super interchangeable, you know, and you know, you can do all sorts of things, and I think that's not going to be. So let's, you know, maybe get a, you know, someone who's more of a true 2-3 there. You know, the challenge, I think, with the Denver fit is, if it was Michael Porter Jr., done. I don't think Denver's going to go there for Aaron Gordon. So then it becomes Gary Harris, I guess, maybe. I would want RJ Hampton probably in that deal as well. Mm-hmm. Before I would do something like that. But yeah, maybe if that's the direction they wanted to go, you know, sure, why not? Other than that, that's what you're looking for. You want somebody who's a 2-3, who has, you know, not just potential, but you actually believe can really be something. You definitely want that back, probably, you know, and if not, then it's going to have to be supplemented in picks. With Vucevic, I can tell you they want multiple first-round picks. They want young players that can play. They want the whole, you know, deal. They want, you know, everything that they can get. And as we talked about early in the show, that's not what the market is kind of demanding. So they're going to ask for everything under the sun. Like, examples, you know, that's another guy the Celtics have a lot of interest in. They're gonna ask for, you know, all right, well, if you're not gonna give us Brown, which Boston's not gonna do, then we want three of the kids, plus we want every pick you can give us, plus pick swaps, because the kids just aren't simply good enough to make up that difference. And that's where it gets to the point, if you're the Celtics, like, all right, this guy doesn't make us necessarily a title contender. So they then will turn around and back out on that end. So that's where it gets a little bit weird right now. He's just one of those guys who's so valuable to Orlando at the moment. I just don't see anybody meeting the giant asking price they're going to put on him.
Okay. No, I mean, that seems fair, considering what a guy like Drew Holiday went for. I think it makes sense that you kind of look at that deal and you kind of go, we have a guy who, offensively at the least, is one of the best offensive centers in the entire league. We have certain expectations of him, or what you can fetch for him if we trade him. Because considering his production on the court, like, that's a lot of stuff you give up there. Like 24 points, what, 10-plus rebounds, maybe 11-plus rebounds. I don't have a stat line in front of me, but it's significant. Plus playmaking, plus shooting, like, that's going to cost you. Is it realistic that Vooch is getting moved at all, or are the Magic eventually going to find themselves in a situation where, you know, he's been there for so long that they might as well keep him around, just for not nostalgia's sake, but to build that brand around him?
Yeah, I absolutely. Yeah, that's it. You know, he's, you know, kind of their guy now, and that's going to be the direction this goes.
And they might, I mean, they, what worked in favor of the Pelicans for Drew is, like, the Bucks were so desperate to do anything they could to satisfy Giannis and get him to sign that Supermax. Like, the Magic might be holding out for the next version of that, and I don't know who that player is. You know, I feel like Devin Booker would have been the easy choice had the Suns not done what they did this past summer, and like the Towns or the T-Wolves with Towns, but you know, I don't see a Towns Vooch front court working necessarily. So like I don't know. Look, maybe the Bulls with LaVine. Like maybe the Bulls in a year get to the point where, you know, they're, we'll see what happens with Markkanen in the summer or even at the trade deadline, but maybe, you know, they're not sold on Wendell Carter Jr. anymore and they're not sold on Kobe White or whatever, and that like LaVine's starting to get antsy and his free agency is coming up. So maybe that's where, you know, the Magic can suddenly extort the Bulls and say, okay, give us the farm for Vooch, or you know LaVine is leaving this summer.
Yeah, but how long does that, how like how far does that take you? LaVine, Vooch. Like, because if you, then you have to give up virtually everything around LaVine, and then you're just creating a different hole, right?
Yeah. I'm not saying it's the right fit, but just something along those lines where you have a star coming up, Bradley Beal too with Washington.
That's like, that's the one I was going to go to.
Yeah. Like, you have a star coming up to free agency who, you know, has given signals that he is not fully committed, and you have to make some sort of all-in push there. I mean, I would be surprised if it happens this year. But Keith, I quickly want to ask about Fournier because he's a guy who's come up, you know, as a possible Sixers target. What are the Magic expecting in return for him? Or, like, what would they be willing to move him for? Is a late first enough?
Yeah, it's probably in that range. I think they'd ideally like a player and a pick. For him, but yeah, if they could get a late first, that's, you know, they can feel pretty good is going to be, you know, in the 20 to 25 range versus the 25 to 30, you know, sure, why not? You know, that may be one where, you know, they may want to say, hey, give it to us 2 years from now and see if your situation changes, something like that. You could even maybe see one of those ones where it becomes reverse protected, where it's like protected if it's, you know, 25 to 30, but if it's lower, we get it, something like that for him, because there's a very much a growing sentiment that he's probably not going to be back in Orlando next year. And once that starts to really become where it's at, I think you really have to start to say, all right, if he's not going to be back, you know, we kind of get a, we're not going anywhere with him this season. So you got to kind of get out of it, whatever you can. The challenge is he's got a pretty movable contract because he's only a little over $17 million. So that's going to mean, you know, they should be able to drive a very, very light bidding war for him. And that should allow them to get, you know, kind of more of what is a reasonable price versus just take whatever we can get for him. I do think people maybe have a little bit of a weird sense of what Fournier is. It's not that he's not good. He's just, anytime the Magic have given him the ball more, he either breaks down physically or you start to see those holes really exposed. But if he's your seventh best player, you're probably in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, more, you mentioned Aaron Gordon to Denver earlier. I want to see Fournier in Denver. I feel like that could be a lot.
Back in Denver. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you could do like Will Barton in the pick. And I would assume, I don't know if that's gap legal. Throw in a contract if you need to. But
oh, that would work.
Yeah. Will Barton this year's first.
I would do that if I was the Magic. I'd be all over that. Because even if Barton walks, you're in the same place and you got a pick out of it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I would think he'd be an upgrade for Denver. And you could, you know, have a Murray, Fournier, MPJ, Jokic, and I don't care who the fifth guy is. That's pretty interesting.
Who you have punted on defense as much as you possibly can at that point.
Well, maybe not, because what could Michael Porter Jr. fetch?
Oh, well,
oh boy. Yeah. Oh, boy. Not this again.
Yeah. Now if you're going in that direction, that opens up a world of possibilities.
Yep. No, but yeah, we had it last episode. I came up with some scenarios that were less Denver's fans were less than enthused. Let's just put it that way. But,
yes.
But yeah. I mean,
shout out to Ryan Blackburn, who is still, he might never listen to this podcast again because of it.
I'm okay with that. I'll survive. But no, it's ultimately, you know, I think it could be fun to see, you know, Fournier in Denver. Look, just the way that he would space the floor for Jokic and give them that space, uncanny. All right, last team, the Houston Rockets. You know, PJ Tucker is no longer playing for them, essentially. He's sitting down there trying to work out a solution, very similar to the LaMarcus Aldridge San Antonio Spurs case. So, guys, PJ Tucker is approximately 475,000 years old. What is a realistic expectation in terms of a return for him? Keith.
Give me 2 seconds. Right. I think, you know, hopefully, you know, maybe you get enough of the teams that think, you know, all right, he can really be a key piece for us to win a championship involved, and somebody gives you a late first. But that's kind of probably the more of a pipe dream. But 2 seconds, I think, is all you can really ask for. He really hasn't played very well this year. You know, now I'm not going to hold that too against him. That team's an absolute disaster. So I'm not, you know, going to, you know, read anything into that. But it's just, you know, he's not what he was even a couple years ago as a defender. He's always been a little bit of a shaky shooter. So, yeah, I would say a couple seconds is probably best. Maybe you could get somebody who makes a similar-ish salary back that you could kind of take a flyer on and see if, you know, maybe they pop for you the rest of the way.
Brian, yeah. Is his 4.4 points per game in 30 minutes attractive to you?
Honestly, yes. It really he is on my list of Sixers trade targets. So, yeah, nice. I mean, he can fit into the Sixers trade exception, which so they didn't have to send any salary back if Houston just wants to dump as much money as possible, which, knowing Tillman Fertitta, that is always the case. Would I give up 2 seconds for him? Probably not. If it's like the Knicks second this year, which the Sixers own, yeah, I would do that for PJ Tucker, because I think for the Sixers in particular, he would unlock some interesting lineup combinations where, you know, they've talked about wanting a stretch big for a while, and Bielitsa, Mike Muscala, Ersan Ilyasova before he signed with the Jazz, those types of guys come up. Tucker is not that. He is not nearly as consistent of a shooter, but we've seen over the last couple of years he can play that small ball five role. He can also just stand in the corner and knock down threes on occasion, so you can get some, you know, Simmons, Tucker, back, like front court when Embiid is not on the floor, Simmons, Tucker with three shooters, and I think that would be a really interesting look. Yes, he is definitely fading in terms of effectiveness, but again, it's like Blake Griffin, like LaMarcus Aldridge, what we said earlier, you're not asking PJ Tucker, if you're a contender, to come in and play 30 minutes a game. You're asking him to play 15 or 20 off the bench and just be your sixth option offensively. So honestly, yes, I am interested in him. I'm not out on him. I think the Rockets have absolutely no reason to hold on to him. So even if they can't find a taker, they should buy him out, and I would assume they will, just to curry favor with his agent, if nothing else. But, you know, he's turning 36 in May, last year of his contract. He's been frustrated for a year that they didn't sign him to extension. He is very clearly not going to be with this team for very much longer.
So since you're interested, what is the max you want to give up just in terms of trade assets for him? You mentioned the TPE, of course, like you can absorb in that way, but you need to give something up of value, I have to assume. So what is your max pain threshold in terms of giving up asset?
Yeah, it would be the Knicks second rounder, and then if Houston wanted any of these end of bench flyers like a Tony Bradley, who really boosted his trade value last night, or, you know, Terrence Ferguson, someone like that.
That's the guy I'd do. Terrence Ferguson. Yeah. If I was Houston, I'd do that too. I'd take the Knicks second and Terrence Ferguson, see if Ferguson can pop in the, you know, remainder of the season. Then he's a restricted free agent. You know, and maybe you can figure something out to keep him. That's the type of return I think you're looking at.
Yeah, and Philly, I think, would have zero problem doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. I'd ask for Isaiah Joe first and get told no, and then I'd just take Ferguson in a pick and move on.
Or B-ball Paul, but I guess he's on a two-way. You can't take him. But Morey is very in love with Paul Reed.
Well, you can trade two-way guys, but yeah, they're not going to do that. That one, though, I do feel a little like that's where it could get a little weird of like, you got to give us two picks just because it's dealing with Morey. I think that's where that one gets a little messy.
Definitely, yeah.
Then let's end this podcast on one of the more intriguing names in the trade deadline. Victor Oladipo. It seems that he just does not want to be anywhere, it seems like. So, guys, what's going on here? What's gonna happen? Is he a Rocket by the March 25th trade deadline, Keith?
Absolutely not. Well, maybe by the deadline, but not by the day or two after.
The 26th, my apologies.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, but by the time a buyout would happen, he's not going to finish the year on the Rockets. It's just not going to happen. When he turned down that extension, which is roughly the amount of money he's looking at as a free agent, that very much said to me, Victor Oladipo was like, I'm done. I'm not staying here. That was, made clear at that point. So I think what you're looking at is they'll probably do everything they can to trade him. They may find it. $21 million's not that hard to move. It's anything $25 million and above starts to get a little tricky. Once you get to, down around $21 million, it's there. It just teams will still talk themselves into, well, if he gets healthy, he could get back to being the guy he was at 1 year in Indiana. My challenge is he's now 28. He'll be 29 at the end of the season. He's had major injuries. I just start to look at it, and this is Brian said this earlier, but one of my favorite things to say, eventually players become more name than game. And that's where I think Victor Oladipo is starting to head towards. And I think everybody is working under the assumption he's going to Miami this offseason. And what it would not surprise me is Victor Oladipo somehow by the start of next season is a Miami member of the Miami Heat. And then he is in incredible shape and has a great year. And we're all like, man, why did nobody trade for Victor Oladipo a year ago? That wouldn't shock me in the slightest.
Yeah, Jake Fisher of Bleacher Report posted a piece earlier this week where he talked to some league execs about the Rockets. They're all saying it's going to be a fire sale, not only Tucker and Oladipo, but even some of these younger guys that, like the Sterling Brown, Ben McLemore, Daniel House, even Jayshon Tate, the guys are sniffing around at least. He said he spoke to some league executives who said Oladipo is looking for a maximum salary over a long-term deal. So I think that, more than anything, between that and all of this like smoke around Oladipo wanting to go to Miami, that's just going to limit what teams are willing to offer him. If you're viewing him as a 2-year or 2-month rental or 2 month plus the playoffs, he hasn't been super effective since coming to Houston. So like, are you going to be willing to give up a good first round pick for him? You shouldn't be.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. I wouldn't. I would, that would have to be one of the, it's like kind of what we just talked about. I'd give up a late first for him if and only I believed that this guy is really going to push us, forward and into, being a true title contender. And I just find it hard to believe anybody can look at him at this point and think that.
Yeah. I would agree with that. It seems that right now he is just discontent until he reaches that specific place where he is going to be content, very like Jimmy Butler in Miami, coincidentally. But in terms, Keith, I actually think I agree with you just in the sense of he had that one good year. This is something that Brian and I have talked about at length before as well. It seems that 1 year is more the outlier than anything else, yet the overall fan perception seems to be that that's the norm for him. That 1 year, apparently, despite all logic proving otherwise, that's the new norm for him, which I just cannot comprehend.
Takes a long time for people to buy into a player being an all-star, and then it takes even longer for people to believe that he's no longer that guy. Just the way it works. People think, a guy can always get back to the height of what he wants. I mean, we just saw it with Blake Griffin. There are people who are convinced that he is the reason that the Nets should now be the favorite to win the title. And it's like, have you not watched Blake Griffin for 2 seasons? I mean, I like Blake Griffin. Quite frankly, I hope Blake Griffin comes out and dominates and is great. That would be awesome for him. I loved watching Blake Griffin. He's just not that guy anymore, but that's just people see the name Blake Griffin and they remember what Blake Griffin once was.
And And that's a good place to wrap up. Thanks to everyone for listening today. As a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. We're also on iTunes, wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, and leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out at Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own group and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Morten Jensen, and I was joined, as always, by Brian Toporek and this time Keith Smith. Later, guys.
Have a good one. Don't mess too much up without me.
Oh, I will definitely mess something up for sure.
Right, stay well, safe, guys.
Yeah, don't die, Mort.
You too, man. Later.